welcome to talk number 5 in Planetary Tantra. This is the first time that John and I have spoken in an interview manner since the horrendous earthquake that happened here on March the 11th here in Japan. So we're going to touch on that a bit, and then we're going to get into some deeper parts of the changes that are going on in the divine experiment. And before I bring John on the line, there is one thing I would like to say here. After I have connected in with Planetary Tantra roughly 3.5 months ago, my tolerance for people who are muddying the waters and putting out disinformation and basically just lying, my tolerance has completely just gone out the window. And so I would like to really kind of pay tribute to John as being a man of truth in the manner that Krishnamurti spoke of what he considered a man of truth to be. And he said that he didn't consider a man of truth to be someone who was in alignment with the truth, but someone who was actually an embodiment of it. And that even if such a man were to get off track now and then, he would immediately brush himself off and get back on track. And that's how my communications with John over these past 4 months have been. And I would just like to pay a little bit of tribute and honor to that incredible integrity and years of research. So, John, I don't want to make you feel a little embarrassed there or shy, but I just want to get that out there. And with that, I welcome you to our 5th talk on Planetary Tantra.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Good to be with you.
Now, where should we start here, John? I guess we could kind of talk, kind of touch on what happened here in Japan, because it was a major development.
Yeah, I think we could go back and try to pick up things. We tried to do this interview a couple of times before, so let's loop back and then come forward from there.
Great. Well, I've talked about what happened in my own experience here several times on other shows and other interviews. So I'll just put it very briefly that the energies that were released in that earthquake, as people can imagine, were absolutely horrendous. It was like being elevated above the mouth of a roaring dragon. An incredible, incredible exposure to these energies. And it just kind of opened my eyes to an even deeper level of how, in a sense, violent and monstrous can be the energies of the earth. And we need to kind of look at what are going to be the implications of what has happened here in Japan on many fronts. One of them would be the possible development of free energy coming out here in Japan. John, how do you look upon what happened with this incredible earthquake and tsunamis?
Well, for me, it's closely timed to some momentous events in the life of the planetary goddess. And I find that there is a remarkable convergence between my understanding of her consciousness and the way that she operates and this event, this earthquake, and the series of earthquakes to which it belongs, actually, these earthquakes that are rippling around the Pacific Rim right now, around the so-called Ring of Fire. So I think that it's a tremendous moment for humanity, and the possibility of participating with Gaia in the correction of her own process, as the Gnostics called it, is in a sense being signaled by this event. So it's really momentous and of course a huge challenge from many other viewpoints as well. Health viewpoint, practical viewpoint. It's, as far as I'm concerned, this is a huge challenge to even know what's going on, because the information regarding the consequences of this quake over the last month has been very difficult to sort out.
Exactly. And that's something we're going to touch upon in the latter half here. But Yes, it's been such a muddle of information. It's on two extremes. What I'm getting here in Japan is that basically the radiation never was a major problem, and it's been under control basically from the beginning. And then from the foreign media, we're getting just bombarded with news that we're all going to turn into slime balls here, and that Japan will be uninhabitable in a few months. So
exactly, there are the two great extremes of information that have been circulated around the planet. And I think one of the highlights of this event that might register in many people's minds is the nature of information in our time. We've become accustomed to the idea of hoaxes. And this is, from a Gnostic viewpoint, you would call this an archontic phenomenon. It falls into the realm of the archons, because the nature of the archons is to deceive and to fake. And of course, a hoax is a faked event. Well, certainly the earthquake has not been a faked event, but the stories that are being told about its consequences may be hoaxes. And so we know, for instance, that 9/11 was not a faked event. It was not a faked event in the sense that the buildings really came down and certain numbers of people really died. And not only the people who died on that day, but subsequently other people died who were involved in dealing with those events, the firemen, the cleanup people. None of that was fake, but there was an enormous fabrication of fakery and hoax around that event. So 9/11 was sort of the initiation into this question. How much of anything that happens on this planet is actually true, and how much of it is a fake and a hoax? For instance, the swine flu proved to be largely a fake. Global warming as a man-made phenomenon proved to be largely a fake. We know that there are aspects of global warming taking place, but the scenario of human-generated global warming is a fake, is a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is a pattern we've been in for quite a while now. Everywhere we turn in the global situation, there have been so-called democratic revolutions in Libya and Egypt in the same time frame as this earthquake. Now we're beginning to see that those are actually fakes. They're not really democratic uprisings of the people, but they have been probably orchestrated events using that as a pretext. So it's enough to drive you out of your mind, really, sitting back in your own life, trying to figure out what part of an event is actually real and what part of it is faked or exaggerated or hoaxed. And this is a huge, huge challenge for us, for humanity right now. And it's no accident that this challenge has arisen at the same time that Gaia is undertaking her own correction, that is, realigning herself to the galactic center.
Yeah, and that's a major thing that we'll get into in a few minutes here. So keep that in the back of your mind here. But yeah, it's kind of how you have spelled out in previous interviews in the Maha Nirvana, where they talk about the end in the Kali Yuga times, at the end part of the Kali Yuga times especially, we'd be in such a mess that we wouldn't know, up from down and black from white. And we really are seeing the extremes of that right now. You don't know where to turn for real information.
Right. The Mahanirvana Tantra, one of the very few tantric texts that were written down, because Tantra was and always will be largely an oral transmission, points ahead to the last two centuries of Kali Yuga, which is right now. That makes it very clear that in this time, there will be an enormous amount of fakery. And I would point out that the emphasis of this prediction, if you want to call it that, in the Mahanirvana Tantra, the emphasis of it is very peculiar and striking. The warning is not that it will be difficult to tell the genuine from the fake, but that it will be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very interesting piece of advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reflecting on that a lot lately. And how to interpret that without taking it as a statement of complete despair and powerlessness, which I don't think it is. I think it's a very significant piece of spiritual insight. But I think that it would have to be qualified, Thomas, and so I just would qualify it in this way. It would change the syntax a little bit, since syntax is the business of the Nahual. I would put it in this way. We're living in a time when it is impossible for the intellect to distinguish between what is true and what is fake. So if you're trying to figure it out with your mind alone and with your intellect alone, you're not going to be able to do it. Or you're going to be able to maybe get close, but will ultimately not be able to make that distinction between what is true and what is faked. That means that we are deep into the archontic influences.
Mm-hmm.
But on the positive note, I would say that how can I turn this to a positive expression? I would put it in this way. Although you have to trust some other power in yourself, trust the intuitions of your heart, trust what your body is telling you. The mind, in certain instances, may not be able to figure out what is true and what is fake. Going back to 9/11, even the best of research work and the most meticulous scrutiny of the evidence at the end of the day may not be able to distinguish what was true and what was fake, because some massive power of illusion was used in that event. But we can know the truth of that event. We can know the essential human truth through some way that is deeper than the intellect, through some form of knowing that is deeper than the intellect. I would say the knowing of the heart, the knowing of the body, and the knowing of Gaia herself. She knows. And we would really have to rely upon her in order to ultimately sort out these matters. That's my hit.
I like that. Yeah, I sensed that that was where you were going with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wrote down on my paper here that that other way of knowing would kind of imply then a direct communication with Gaia Sophia herself. And that I have a feeling that that's why ever since I connected into Planetary Tantra, and especially since I took the Gaian vow, as I said at the beginning there, I've lost all tolerance for people who lie and deliberately mislead people, because I think I've opened up to a different type of a communication or source of information, in a sense, that so denies and shows up these lies. So a direct communication with the Earth Goddess itself is probably the best way to go.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, and I'm having a parallel experience. I cannot tolerate the slightest kind of deceit
mm-hmm.
in personal life, people who lie around me. I've been encouraged by some some social acquaintances, who are more or less of the new age disposition, to let it go, to don't confront someone on their lies, and, mm-hmm. That's what they need to do. That's their reality. Well, I totally disagree, and I will confront anybody that lies to me in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. I would point out something that is probably obvious to everyone who will be listening to this interview. There are malicious, malevolent, and brutally murderous forces of social evil operating on this planet. You are lucky if they don't touch your life directly. But since illusion, since separation is an illusion, any evil that is done anywhere in the world touches us, because there is no separation on this planet. And we see this evil being perpetrated. You can blame it on whoever you want. Don't blame it on the Archons, or don't blame it on any extra human agencies, because even though they may be playing a role in the game, the source of all human evil, the source of all evil on Earth is human. It's human evil. But I would point out the most essential insight, which we required from the Gnostics, that this evil could not be perpetrated if it wasn't for deception. The nature of the archonic mind is to deceive and fake and pretend. And none of this evil could be carried out if it weren't done under the cloak of massive, massive deception.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are all committed to face this deception, to face lies and deception at every level of existence. And the more that you engage with Gaia Sophia, the more that you accept that her life is yours, you have no life of your own without her life, the more that you engage your consciousness with hers, the more that you realize that you must take a stand against deception at every single level. And at the ultimate level, we can break through this deception. The human species can break through the great deception that is doing so much harm on the planet. But we can only do it in cooperation with her and through her powers and through her teaching and her wisdom. Can't do it on our own.
Absolutely. There's a sense of innocence that comes into play here when you start to work with naked eye observation of the lunar cycles and reflecting upon, you know, the Gnostic writings. There's that kind of just comes out on its own, I believe. It's not a powerless type of an innocence. It's a powerful, you know, type of innocence that comes about. And so in contrast with that, when the lies come out, they're just so obvious.
Yeah, it's innocence, you know, is a very key quality in the practice of planetary tantra. In regard to Gaia herself, she created us in innocence. Our Edenic terrestrial paradise is a realm of innocence. And there is a great power in that primordial innocence. But also Kali, who represents the wrath of Gaia, places an enormous value on innocence. If you would consider yourself to join the band of Kali and become one of her warriors, defending the earth and defending humanity, then you would qualify in her eyes through your innocence. And you make a really good point there, Thomas, is this innocence that we recapture, that we reclaim through the Sophianic connection, is not a blind vulnerability. On the contrary, it's connected with a deep, deep knowing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even the old corrupt fairy tale of the Bible tells you that, because when we see Adam and Eve, who represent the human genome, or the first human beings to appear on the earth, derived from the genome, when we see them in the Garden of Eden, we see them in a state of innocence, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is the primordial state. And yet at the same time, what happens in the Garden of Eden? They have a transaction with the serpent, who is an emissary of Gaia and a teacher of the mysteries of the earth and of the organic light. So they have an encounter with the serpent, who offers them the highest godlike knowing. So what is it? Even in that corrupt fairy tale, we can draw a moral, we can draw a lesson. That is, that the highest state of human innocence is not incompatible with the highest intelligence of the human species. Not at all. Innocence is not naivete, not in the sense that we're talking about it here.
Mm-hmm.
The highest innocence of our species is absolutely compatible with the highest intelligent potential of our species. And that's a really great lesson, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Innocence, we kind of sometimes have an image of it as being like a lamb or something that doesn't really fight back. But when it's a Kali form of innocence, it's ready to fight. You know, it's ready to take on the problems of the world.
Indeed. Exactly. Well said.
And we talked just a bit about the the muddle about the possible consequences of like the radiation taking place here in Japan. But we also have to look at kind of the lies that a lot of people are spreading about the cause of the earthquake itself. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but just want to get your thoughts on that a bit. Because in my mind, this has been a completely natural occurrence. I don't see any signs that this has been man-made, as you know, many people out there are saying. And in one of our communications here, you'd mentioned some reports by a fellow named Piers Corbin, and he talked about the lunar perigee and the, I think also the solar flares that were pretty active there just before it happened. Do you want to comment on what you think was, in a sense, the cause of the earthquake?
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, Piers Corbin is this weatherman extraordinaire who talks about earth changes and has a very high level of veracity. I think his site is called weatheraction.com. Anyway, what I like about Piers Corbin is that he talks about weather and global climatic change in a context which I understand. Because I've studied and developed it over the last 30 or 35 years. One of the things we learn from the Gnostic myth of the divine Sophia is that she had a prevision of how the human species would evolve. She had a fantasy, as you will, in her imagination. She projected a vision of our species, and she put us in a certain habitat. And as Sophia herself, a goddess in the galactic center, pictured this experiment with humanity, she saw it in a three-body system. She saw us living not in a solar system of 7, 8, or 9 planets, but she saw us living on a planet, an Earth-like planet, surrounded by, circulated by a moon connected to a sun. So moon, sun, Earth, the three-body system, was actually Sophia's own original view of our habitat in the cosmos. Actually, what we do end up with, due to the archontic deviation, is we end up with that three-body system, sun, moon, Earth, captured in an inorganic planetary system. The amazing thing about Piers Corbin is that he develops his weather predictions and his understanding of the geophysics and climactic changes now in terms of the three-body system. So he's looking at solar flares as they impact the Earth, as they are related to earthquakes. In some way, they are intimately related to earthquakes. I don't quite understand that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, they impact the magnetosphere of the Earth in such a way that it induces earthquakes. He's very, very clear on that. He's very clear on that, but he's even clearer on the dynamics of the Earth-Moon system and the apogee and perigee of the Moon, the two points where it is most distant and most close to the Earth, and things like that. So he's using this three-body model, which is a Gnostic cosmology model, in order to read the Earth changes. Now, if you work within his framework and you follow his method, which is not difficult to follow because he's talking about things we can observe, you could come to the conclusion that the Japanese earthquake, which I think he almost predicted, is totally a result of these factors, of these of this three-body dynamic. It's caused to a certain extent by the intensity of solar flares, which is becoming huge now, and from another angle by the interaction between the Earth and the Moon, which both rotate around a common center of mass called the barycenter. And that's how he sees it. And you don't have to bring in HAARP. You don't have to assume that there is a mysterious scalar weapons being used. You can totally go with that viewpoint if you want to. Keep it totally confined to natural causes, you know. I would actually prefer to do that, Thomas, if you would ask me, you know, what I would like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I would feel irresponsible if I, by ignoring these other factors. Mainly, there's a big rumor going around the planet that says that the evil powers, the New World Order, Illuminati, slash psychopath control freaks, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
I call them the NEWOs, the N-E-W-O-S, NEWOs, the New World Order control freaks, have a mastery of free energy systems, going back to Tesla or maybe even earlier to Faraday and people like that. They hijacked free energy physics, which could be used to turn this planet into a social utopia in 2 weeks, and weaponized it. And they're using it for their insane control games and for their wars, which are profiteering adventures. And in order to, at the worst case scenario, in some eugenics agenda, to depopulate and wipe out the human race. I mean, this is the nightmare that's floating around the planet like a dark cloud. And floating in many people's minds. The nightmare is not to be ignored. In fact, Gaia herself, Gaia Sophia, is extremely aware of this nightmare. She knows the nightmare of the human condition. She created human beings. She created us genetically. And so she knows that we have reached the point of immersing ourselves in this nightmare. Now, if you buy the assumptions and the rumors that are going around, what was one of them? You tell me. People said, well, yeah, there was a 7-point-something quake off the coast of Japan, but it was instigated by an atomic explosion at the tectonic level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or scalar weapons, right?
Mm-hmm. Or HARP, yeah. Yes.
Or HARP, right, blah, blah, blah. So, again, how do we put all this together without going nuts here? Because nobody actually really knows. I would propose two sort of guidelines or approaches to this baffling problem, rather than just going and crawling under the covers and going into the fetal position, which is also an option. You know, one is to assume the very, you know, to give some credit. I think it's highly, highly probable that the physics of free energy systems is known on this planet by certain people, and that it has been hijacked. I think Dr. Judy Wood's work that you just sent me, she just sent me a book, kindly, proves that, points undisputably in that direction, that the DEW, directed energy weapons, scalar weapons, which would be based on free energy systems that could be used to make the world a better place, have been hijacked and weaponized. So, there is a very good probability that the NEWOs could be playing a hand or could have played a hand in the Japanese disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can rule out that possibility. Or in other earthquakes, like the one in Haiti and so forth. You know?
Yes.
Having said that, I would add this caution. Boy, we're having a tremendous thunderstorm and raining storm outside here. So it's amazing that I'm still speaking to you on the internet from Spain. Can you hear it?
Yes, I can hear that. Okay, I'm glad you clarified that that's what it is. I thought someone was using the bathroom there.
Oh, no, this is a massive
wow
thunderstorm going over the house here right now.
Amazing.
So the cautionary remark would be this. While it's probable that these madmen are doing this, at the same time, let's not give them more power than they actually have. You know, one of the things that we understand, or I've come to understand about their MO, the MO of the NEWOs, is that they really love it when the danger that they pose to the world is exaggerated. That makes their work really easy. So when they can get people into a paranoid state where fear is exaggerated, they are really winning their game. There is something to be afraid of. These people are, we should recognize the existence of these people, that they have weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biochemical weapons, and that they are completely out of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, folks, let's admit it. this is what has happened to the human experiment. This is how badly it's gone wrong. So there is reason to be afraid of them, but not to be as afraid of them as they would like us to be. That's where the trap is,
yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
You cannot be. I think there's probably some teachings in the warrior's code of samurai or in the Chinese and Asian martial arts that would say something to that effect. You know, fear your enemy for what they can really do to you, but don't fear them too much. You know?
Absolutely.
I think it's very suspicious that the, so what I'm saying, to boil it all down to one sentence, is there's probably a considerable degree of hoaxing around the assumption that human role in this catastrophe. But they would like to take credit for it. I think it's very suspicious that the activities of the Heart Center in Alaska are supposedly online.
Yeah.
So that you can go onto their website at any time and see when they cranked up the heart machine in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing this. You can go and find numerous YouTube clips. And what do they show? Well, lo and behold, at the moment of the quake in Haiti, at the moment of the quake in Chile, at the moment of the quake in Japan, look, the HARP antenna was fired off at that very moment, or a few days before, you know, or a few hours before. I find that very suspicious. I find that to be possibly a hoax in itself.
Sure.
Because first of all, the government who's running HARP claims that it's not being used for military purposes. Well, if that's the case, why on earth would they make the evidence available that it is?
Exactly. It's a game within a game. Yeah, they put it out
there. It's a game within a game.
Yeah, people buy it up and they've discovered the ultimate weapon. And when you do that, then it takes your eye off what actually could be. You know, maybe there is a different technology being used altogether. But if everyone's focused on HARP, we'll never get to the culprit.
It's a very, very devious game.
Yeah.
If we think that they induced the Japanese earthquake by HARP, we're going to be all terrified, thinking that the Niwos really do have godlike powers and they're going to destroy the planet. And it would be very much to their advantage that we think this way.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, why on earth? Well, you know, maybe they're able to predict very closely to predict earthquakes, and then they put false data on the internet at the moment that these earthquakes happen.
Sure.
So that it appears that they can take credit for creating them. This is very consistent with their MO.
Yeah.
You know? And so we have to be super, super clever to understand how these psychopaths think, but at the same time, not dismiss the fact that they do have terrifying power of destruction in their hands, and yet to be very cautious in assuming how they're handling it and how they're using it. And this current event is a huge lesson in that exercise. Huge.
Yeah, and we can definitely see evidence that they do have access to that power just by looking at what happened on 9/11. And
yeah,
Dr. Wood's
really
book
is
a great place to do that. I would just add one more thing to that part of the conversation, is that if this really was a man-made attack on Japan, it wouldn't make sense from the way they did it anyway, because you wouldn't be attacking the coast along Miyagi. You'd be going after Tokyo or Osaka, you know. In a sense, they really didn't cause any damage to the heart of Japan at all. So, you know, in that sense, too, it wouldn't pan out to be a man-made attack, at least in my mind.
Well, you can really go nuts trying to second guess the motives and the strategies of these people. But in the general view, we face a problem that is almost insoluble. It gets back to what the Mahanirvana Tantra said. We're going to be living in a time when it's just not difficult to tell the fake from real. It's downright impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's downright impossible in the long analysis, let's say, to tell what part of the Japanese disaster was induced by the Niwos and what part of it was a natural phenomenon. So what do we do about that? Well, there is a solution. Solution comes through planetary tantra. As far as I know, planetary tantra is the only practice currently available to us that would provide a solution. Because it allows us to be interactive and communicating with Gaia, with the planet, we can find out what, from the planet, what's happening on the planet. And that's the best source. So we can find out from her by studying her activities right now, by coordinating closely with her through these techniques that Planetary Tantra offers, that we would know what she's doing. And when we know what she's doing, then we're on course for sanity. Because we're never, ever going to be able to figure out what the human predators are doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Never, ultimately.
That's true.
Why we have to liquidate them, basically. That's why we basically have to eliminate them.
Yeah, I agree with your logic on that, yeah.
That's another subject. We'll get into that one of these days.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Yeah. They cannot be figured out. They cannot be brought to accountability.
Yeah.
The best analogy to keep in your mind to not go insane thinking about the Niwos is to consider them to be like serial killers. They are serial killers.
Yeah, not like serial killers.
Serial killers
they are.
Love to play games with their victims.
Yeah.
And they love to play games with the people who are chasing them. And so my advice would be aware that these serial predators are existing. Be aware that they exist and that they are performing heinous orchestrations of evil upon the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But don't get caught up in their games.
Yeah, yeah. It's a never-ending quagmire of quicksand, and you just never get out of it. Yeah.
You never get out of it. And they love it. They love that people are going back to the Egyptian mysteries of Osiris and trying to figure out who the Illuminati are and how they operate in programming our minds. They love that.
Yeah.
Because while you're involved in figuring that out and listening to Michael Tesarian and David Icke and other people, Jordan Maxwell, elaborate on that at length,
mm-hmm.
they're going on their merry way, doing even worse than they were doing before. So if you really want to do something about them, and if you really want to stop them, connect with Gaia Sophia, connect with the planet. And she will not only teach us what is really going on, but she will also teach some of us, such as yours truly, how to take down these predators once and for all.
Absolutely. And I can't wait until the time comes when when you are ready to talk more about that, because I know a bit about what is in the works, and it's a very exciting scenario. Let's see. We kind of want to switch gears and start to getting out of the problem as we usually do and get into into the solution more.
Right.
And to kind of segment into that, I would first like, just briefly, John, if you could touch upon, as is written here in the Maha Nirvana Tantra, it says, "The practices of the devotees of the Earth Goddess are a pleasure to perform." Could we just kind of briefly just kind of touch on what those practices are? I could say a few of the ones that I've been working with are the, I'm getting a little quake here going, wow. Observation of the lunar cycles, naked eye observation, astronomy.
That's right.
Contemplating the Berry Center, observations of the first attention, and on and on, courting as well. What other practices would you add to that, so people could start to investigating on their own?
Well, the practices of Planetary Tantra are actually extremely simple. It is not an advanced system of grades. It does not involve complex methodologies or models and abstractions. It does not involve even any metaphysics. One of the ways that you would be able to discern that Planetary Tantra is completely different from any other current teachings about the Earth or the cosmos is that it has no metaphysics to it at all. Whereas if you go to, say, the channel teachings, and there are many channel teachings around that purport to tell us what's happening on the Earth, aren't there?
Yes.
Many channel teachings that purport to tell us what the planetary shift is about. For instance, Barbara Marciniak and Messages from the Pleiades, Bringers of the Dawn,
mm-hmm.
just one example. You look into the material offered by such people, And you'll find that it consists of masses and masses of layers of metaphysical concepts and ideas, kind of sugared with a confection of New Age love philosophy. Planetary Tantra is nothing like that. First of all, the two things that you encounter when you come into Planetary Tantra is the offer to be engaged, the offer to be interactive with the Earth. So it's a direct interactivity. And the second thing that you encounter is the erotic or hedonistic element, that Planetary Tantra is based not on love, but on pleasure and desire. It is a path of pleasure and desire. You enter the path through desire, you practice it in desire, and you reach the goal by desire. The path, the ground, the path, and the goal are all one. They're all the same. This is not a graduated process. And so it's something that you're only going to get into, not because it engages your intellect or fascinates your mind, but because you sense the pleasure that you will have in practicing it. That's what the Mahanirvana Tantra is suggesting. The practices of the devotees of the Ajna Devi, which is Kali and Gaia, sort of considered as one, are a pleasure to perform.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the rituals and practices here, you do them because you enjoy doing them. They're not something that you do like yoga exercises. Well, I really don't want to do my yoga, but I know that I'm going to have a good result if I do. Planetary Tantra isn't like that at all. The result is in the pleasure of doing it from the get-go. The first step in entering it is to do the Gayan Tantric vow and to use and to perform the ritual of iron binding. It is a simple ritual when you prick your thumb and bleed into the earth. And this is not a silly ritual. This is not like some kind of pagan or neo-pagan or Wiccan idea of sympathetic magic, as it used to be called. It's not some kind of voodoo comparable to sticking pins in dolls. It's actually a energetic ritual by which you intentionally bind the iron in your blood into the magnetic field of the earth. This is the first, as you know, Thomas, because you've done it, this is the entry ritual into Planetary Tantra.
Yeah, and it opens a floodgate of energies and creative imaginations that start to percolate up inside your psyche. Huh?
It really does. In itself, if you just went out and did that, if you just went out and into the field somewhere and pricked your thumb with a pin and stuck it in the ground, it wouldn't do that. Why is it so powerful and why is it so immediate? Well, because when you do it in the simple framework that I've presented in the section of Planetary Tantra on site, you do it in a particular context. You contextualize that simple act. First of all, you recite the names of Gaia. You call forth the attention and the awareness of the planet itself by using her name. You call her name. So that is a special feature of the rite. Second feature of the rite is that you go and undertake the rite knowing that you do it as part of the story and the myth of this goddess. So you learn the myth, which is in the spoken narration that Thomas has done, posted on his website, and will be posted on MetaHistory as well, too. So you know her story. You do it in the context of her story. And another thing about pleasure is that you will get involved in Planetary Tantra. You will be naturally and automatically drawn into it if you enjoy her story. Well, how do you know if you will enjoy it or not? Well, you have to go and listen to it or read about it, and maybe a few times. But if you do that, then you might think, well, that's just something. It's a story about this and that. He uses this language. I'm not interested. And then you go on with your life. But if you find that you really enjoy the story, then you're on. and it starts to work on you immediately.
Mm-hmm.
This is interactive magic. This is no metaphor, folks. This is no term that I cooked up as a promotional gimmick. It is interactive magic.
It
and
is.
As soon as you start to do it, it works on you.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes doing these talks, I'm preparing for the talks and imagining how they might go. I'm often imagining myself pulling in the reins and saying, Thomas, you know, don't go overboard and sound like you're a salesman. But I really need to just say this. This is like nothing I've ever experienced, and I've done all kinds of stuff in my 47 years of life on this planet. This is an absolutely amazing practice. It's an amazing mindset and energy set to be in. I don't want to sound like a salesman, but man, oh man.
I don't want to be a salesman for it either.
Yeah, I know, but you can't hold it
and
back.
And I'm certainly
not
going to go around and sell it and do seminars and workshops and sell products. Because Planetary Tantra, as I've said, is not for sale.
Yeah.
And it is not for profit and never will be.
Yeah.
But it's impossible not to be enthusiastic about it.
Yeah.
Because it is so immediate and so clear once you engage it. So after the initial rite, the iron binding ritual, the pronunciation of Gaia Sophia's name, and then you pronounce your own ritual to her aloud, it's like you make a pact with the earth. And just do it and see what happens. It's amazing. You don't have to believe anything.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out to people that this system of Planetary Tantra is none like any other system. It is not based on wishful thinking or on desire in the sense of desire. It is based on desire, on belief. Mm-hmm. It is not based on belief at all. So, you know, the secret is sort of a big New Age system that's has attracted many people. And the system is based on the idea of, believing that if you believe hard enough that you can have what you want, you'll have it, you know. This Planetary Tantra is not like that at all. It's intentional. It's intentional magic. The reason why is the initial step into Planetary Tantra so powerful, and why does it immediately work? It's very simple, because the trick of this practice is to make intentional that which already exists. It already exists that your body is integrated into the magnetic field of the earth. That is a dynamic that is already operating. The body of every human being has a bloodstream charged with hemoglobin particles, which are charged with iron. So the blood that is streaming through your body right now is filled with iron filings. And if you could step back and see your blood system as a separate entity, it would appear like an antenna consisting of vibrating iron filings. And that electromagnetic antenna in your blood is tuned to the electromagnetic field of the earth. This is a given. This is the way it is right now, whether you do anything about it or not. What happens in the entry rite to Planetary Tantra is that you make that dynamic intentional. You intentionalize what is already happening. And the effect is absolutely immediate. Suddenly you become engaged and interactive with something that was there already. And all of your experiences begin to take on a different direction. They are dynamized because you have made an intentional act, an intentional ritual of magic. This is how it works. It's complete. There's no mystification or mumbo jumbo about it. You don't have to believe anything. All you have to do is do it with a lucid understanding of what you're doing. Then from that point on, we get into the other practices, which are all a pleasure to perform. The observation of the moon is absolutely delightful. You'll get back into looking at the sky. You'll see things you never imagined that you could see. You'll be connected to people at a distance because some people elsewhere in the world are looking for the moon at the same moment that you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing it together. You're performing, in fact, a kind of exercise in telepathy through using the moon as a coordinator. Then you get into the Shakti cluster. It's a way that describes to you It's a model that describes the 18 frequencies, clairaudient frequencies, in which Gaia is transmitting to your very own mind right now. And again, that transmission is already happening, but you make it intentional by undertaking the practice. And so that's it. And from there, it just goes deeper. They're not complicated. You don't have to have a huge system of metaphysical ideas in your backpack in order to do any of these things. The nature of planetary tantra is direct and immediate.
Yes, it absolutely is. And you might want to just add the word that you use here is bima, B-E-M-A.
Right.
Do you want to just go ahead and give a brief description of that, and then we'll jump into the main topic here?
Sure. You can use the old concept of the Trinity. There are trinities and threes come up very often in Gaian geophysics. And when you engage with the Earth, the living planet, you engage with her at three levels simultaneously. The first level is the ground you're standing on. So that's the physical mass of the planet. We call that the telluric ground. T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C means of the earth, you know? So that's the first connection. Through the soles of your feet, preferably bare, walking around on the earth, looking at everything that is in the material earth and perceiving it with your physical senses. That is the telluric connection, first level. Second level you engage is the bima, which is the bioelectromagnetic aura, B-E-M-A. Now, as you stand on the earth, say you stand in a field somewhere looking out across toward some trees, and maybe there are some mountains in the distance, the telluric dimension is obvious. You feel the physical mass of the earth. You see the physical, you see the trees, the rocks, and so forth. But as a matter of fact, the earth has an aura. The aura is what you can't see. It's the air. It's the layer of the energetic field of the earth that lies along the surface, along the material surface. And that is actually the skin of the earth. And that is, I call that the bima, the bioelectric magnetic field. And that's what you engage when you do the rite of iron binding. Then comes the third dimension of the presence of the goddess, and that is the sky. When you look up at the sky, you actually look up into an area of space that is first immediately right in front of your face, and then it goes further and further out, up into the upper regions of the sky, eventually to the point where there is no more oxygen, and up into the troposphere, and then into the ionosphere, and out, then out toward the sun, and the infinity of the universe. So the sky is another dimension of Gaia, but the only part of the sky that really belongs to her body is the part that is bounded by the ionosphere. And that is what's called in ancient times the ambient. So you engage with the sky, you engage with the skin or the electromagnetic field, the bima, and you engage with the material body. It's a triple engagement. And each one, this is not an abstract model I'm giving you. As you know, each one of those engagements can be materialized and ritualized in many, many different ways. And that's what planetary tantra is. It's going deeper and deeper into these engagements. As I speak of these engagements now, you all have them. Everyone who is hearing my words has these engagements already, but you don't have them intentionally. You just have them automatically. Well, you can't do planetary magic with Gaia automatically. She's given you the foundation to do it, but you must take the step to be interactive with her. So the fantastic secret, if I may repeat it just one more time, the secret efficacy of planetary tantra is that it makes intentional, which is already operating.
Yeah, exactly. And that ties in with the Gnostics, how they held the intellect in the highest degree, the highest standard. And so this is kind of the takeoff point or the starting point, in a sense, to get into planetary tantra and connect with Gaia Sophia is the taking the automatic things and bringing them into an intentional and intellectual sphere as well.
That's right. They consider that our intellect, which they call nous, is given to us by Sophia before even the earth was created. Intellect was coded, our intellectual capacities were coded into the human genome by Sophia herself. And then when she morphed into the planet Earth, she is now embodied in the Earth, we have our intellect in order to recognize her. We use our intellect to recognize that which is the source of our existence, not just the source of our existence as biological creatures living on the planet, but also the source of our existence, subjects of her imagination. You know, we are equally, we are biological creatures of the Earth, whether we like it or not. We don't have to do anything about that. But it, you know, again, it's a given, right?
Yeah.
But we're not just her biological progeny. We are also actors and participants in her imagination. That's where it becomes intentional. That's the secret that the Gnostics knew. That's how they were able to create the great tradition of the mystery schools based on the direct encounter with Gaia, Sophia, and based on the experience of her energies and her living intelligence.
Absolutely. And I like how you just spelled out a few minutes ago the three connecting principles there with the telluric grid, the sky, and then the bima. So that's very easy for people to keep in mind and to explore on their own. So, John, let's go ahead.
It really is. And I might add, by the way,
please,
that, folks, that's all there is. You know? Stop dreaming about the cosmos. Stop dreaming about universes without end. And, oh, well, don't we want to know how all that was created and how all the universe was created and what about the multiple worlds? And forget it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't get those three things, you can't get anywhere. Because that's where you go to the rest of the universe from.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that's all there is, folks.
That's all she wrote, huh?
That's all she wrote.
Fantastic. Well, okay, John, we're going to just get into the main topic here. We'll just touch up on it and then pick up on it at a later date. But let's go ahead and jump into what we had actually outlined to talk about, which we have roughly titled The Ultimate Test, Planetary Tantra, and the Future of the Earth. We've already touched a bit upon the archontic media and the mess that we're in with that, and also how the original design for the Anthropos was to be living within a three-body system, but we are
right.
Stuck now with the Archon's habitat and the influences that are going to come from the planets.
That's right.
So let's move into this. So we are, what is it that we are missing in this scenario, in this field trip, this what could be a paradise on Earth? What is it that we're missing in that?
We're missing the savvy of a dangerous animal that is able to recognize its predators. That's what we're missing.
Okay, could you expand on that some more?
Sure. When we consider the Gnostic creation myth of the divine Sophia, it contains a lot of information, if you want to use that crude word. And it tells us, for instance, that the human genome was engineered in the galactic center. Interesting piece of information. In other words, we don't have to buy the story that we are the genetic a slave race, genetically engineered by some extraterrestrial civilization. That's complete disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a con and an error. So it tells us, you know, where the human species originated. It tells us how the Archons arose by an accidental impact that Sophia produced in the galactic limbs when she surged from the Pleromic Core, and on and on. Tells us many things. And these things are not told anywhere else. Please let me reemphasize that. I don't like to repeat myself, but certain things have to be made crystal clear. There's no other story that tells us so many things about the human condition. To get to your question, Thomas, one of the things that the story tells us is that Sophia had a prevision of a divine experiment with the human race. Then when she plunged from the galactic center and produced the archons, she herself, unwittingly, you could say, certainly not deliberately, introduced something into the experiment that she didn't anticipate. Now try to follow the plot here, the plot of the story. The human genome was engineered in the galactic center, the Pleroma, before Sophia fell, and therefore before she produced the Archon world. It's very important to get that sequence down. Then the Archon world arose and formed, the solar system arose and formed, before the Earth was formed. The solar system arose and formed a number of planets exclusive of the Earth. Then the Earth itself was formed from Sophia's body, and it was captured in the solar system. So consider the plot. Consider that sequence for a moment. That being the case, the myth tells us something that is extremely important to understand the ultimate test we face today. When Gaia, as Sophia, engineered the human genome, she encoded it with certain capacities. Those capacities are very specifically described in Gnostic writings as nous. They're all variations of nous, or divine intelligence. So she gave us, we have divine intelligence. Our intelligence is divine. It is a germ of divinity. We have a divine faculty. And it has various manifestations, such as dianoia, the capacity to communicate, metanoia, the capacity to move through different paradigms or models and not be caught in any one, epinoia, the capacity for imagination, and enoia, or intentionality. So all of these capacities are encoded in the human genome before Gaia plunges, before the Archons arise. It stands to reason, then, if you follow the plot, that she did not encode into our genome the capacities to deal with the Archon threat, because it didn't exist at the time that she did the encoding.
Absolutely. Yeah, let that sink in a bit. That's a major point to work into your perception of the story and a perception of our predicament. Yeah.
That is really a major point of the story. Really. In other words, she didn't equip us to face interspecies predators. Now, when you look at the habitat of the habitat of the Earth arose due to the metamorphosis of her own body. She is here present right now in the material Earth, although she is not limited to the material Earth. She can manifest herself in her original form, the living luminosity of her original pleromic form, which is called the organic light. But as far as the natural habitat is concerned, she appears as the material planet. And on this planet live all these creatures: insects, snakes, animals, cats, tigers, whales, elephants. And if you look at, and human beings, and if you look at all these creatures, you will find that humanity is different from all other species in this one respect. Several respects, but let's just focus on one. Take any species you like. Take butterflies, take salmon, take lions, take antelopes. These species do not prey on themselves. In fact, this is a fantastic story that I love to contemplate, and something that I have, through this story, I have received and continue to receive beautiful instruction from Gaia about how she arranged the prey-predator bond. Not talking about the victim-perpetrator bond now, which is the subject of my book. I'm talking about the prey-predator bond. She has shown me some of the most beautiful truths regarding the prey-predator bond. What is the prey-predator bond? It means that when Gaia allowed, when she produced these animal species in the earthly habitat, she set up rules for their interactions with each other. So, an example of the prey-predator bond would be this. The leopard in the African veld preys on certain other animals. It doesn't prey on all the other animals in the veld. It has a selected range of prey, namely certain antelopes and deer or buffaloes.
Sure.
Okay? And it remains, according to the rules that she has laid down in the instinctual programs of these animals, the leopard has, let's say, a range of 5 or 6 animals that it preys on. This is not a victim scenario, because those animals also depend on the predator, because the relation between the leopard, who preys on the antelopes, is a symbiotic relationship. The leopards do not wipe out the entire population of the antelopes. They do not perform antelope genocide, do they?
Yes, and I would just point out that they also go after usually the weakest member of the herd.
Well,
they're going
after the ones they can catch.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would go after a weak one if there's a weak one there.
Yeah.
But sometimes there isn't a weak one there. So what happens when there isn't a weak one there? Well, then it's a chase.
It's the closest one. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the closest one, and it's a beautiful, beautiful chase.
Sure.
Have you ever seen a leopard or a cheetah chase an antelope? You might find it distasteful, because you might think you're a human being and you're beyond that kind of thing. I totally disagree. It's a fantastic ballet of beauty and strength. And in a certain sense, you can see that they're playing with each other. And when the cheetah finally gets that antelope, if it does, it goes for it and goes for its neck, the antelope goes into a trance.
Yeah.
Because Gaia provides the prey with certain chemicals and hormones that allow them to go into a kind of anesthetic trance when they have been captured by the predator. The whole arrangement of predator and prey all through all the kingdoms of nature is set up in the most exquisite balance, and with a beauty and with a compassion for both the prey and the predator, that comes out of the nature of Gaia herself, comes out of the wisdom of her understanding of living creatures. And none of these creatures, the great predators — I always think of the great predator cats because I love them so much — none of these creatures prey on their own species. Now turn around and look at the human species. Not only do we prey on every other species on the planet, from whales to snails, but we also prey on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, we are not subject to the sublime ethical and aesthetic rules of the prey-predator bond. We are not subject to that. And we're not supposed to be, because she gave us a much greater latitude of free will. She didn't bind us to a particular instinctual program, and she relied on us to understand her laws and to follow her laws voluntarily in order to limit and restrict our predatory behavior. In an ideal situation, that is what we would do. If we were sane, let me put it in that way. If we were sane, That is what we would do. We would look at nature. We would see how the other animals operate, how they are subject to these laws, and we would voluntarily agree to follow those laws because we see that they are the laws that Gaia herself has presented for the preservation of her world. That's what we would do if we do not have the archontic element in our face. So, to get back to the story, again, I just remake the essential point. When Gaia engineered the human genome, she didn't equip us to deal with the predatory excesses of our own species. You understand that?
Yes.
So now that those predatory excesses have reached their endgame scenario, we are lacking. They have an advantage over us. The human beings who have become so deviated and so pathological that they're preying on the rest of the human species have an advantage over their prey. That the prey, which would be decent, good-natured people who just want to get along with each other and thrive, who just want to enjoy life and who want to coexist and exhibit some degree of mutual aid, because life gets much easier when we help each other, those people are at a severe disadvantage because Gaia did not endow them with the savvy of a dangerous animal that can recognize its own, its predators. And this is our problem. This is the ultimate challenge.
Exactly. Wow, I just had a flash of insight there, and that is where Planetary Tantra comes in. That's endowing that innocence with what we talked about earlier, the wrath and the intelligence of Kali. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Kali represents that part of Gaia that we need to take upon ourselves. When we engage with Gaia, she gives us the Kali frequencies, as it were. She gives us the... She brings that goddess power into our field of intention. She makes it accessible to us. And with that Kali warrior power, we can overcome the disadvantage that we have, you know, disadvantage that we have against these planetary predators. They are interspecies predators. They are not superhuman. They are human. They are subhuman, actually.
Subhuman, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. They are not superhuman masterminds of, you know, awful programs of mind control and all that. They are just very clever, and they use our own disadvantage very, very well. They know that a psychopath who shows up at a party of 100 people knows that the people at that party are not going to be suspecting to be duped and deceived and controlled and manipulated. This is the weakness of our species. Sophia did not endow us with the capacity to deal with deception, duping, and manipulation to the degree that we must if we're going to change the situation. And this is the great challenge to face these predators. And we can't do it alone. We can't do it by any other means that existed up until this point. We can only do it by moving forward in time in a warrior commitment to Gaia and learning through her, learning through Kali, how to be warriors who can overcome the predators in our own midst. This is the ultimate challenge for our species.
Yeah, it's amazing. The subtleties of the logic and how this all ties in together, it astounds me sometimes how the pieces all fit together. And you just put another major piece of the puzzle in place there. That I really appreciate that.
Well, if we have the master story, Thomas, they really fit together. You know, it's quite, I mean, step back and take a few breaths and just reflect on this, that we are not genetically endowed in our original genetic makeup with the skills that it takes to meet and defeat predators in our own midst. Doesn't that explain some things?
It sure does. And it explains why, for the vast majority of people, this is something that is impossible to comprehend, that there could be, you know, a segment of society that literally lives off the rest of us.
Yeah, it's even it's even difficult for people to conceive what a psychopath is.
Yeah,
I think I said in one of our previous talks, however, speaking very much in the same vein, if you consider yourself a responsible human being, you better know what a psychopath is, and you better know how to profile one, not only to understand what psychopathic behavior is, but how to detect one if you're in the presence of one. And if you don't know that, you're not a responsible human being. Mm-hmm. But that is something that we have to learn with painful difficulty, because genetically, morally speaking, we were not equipped to face that danger. It was not originally preconceived as part of the of our experiment. It's where the experiment went wrong. And Gaia is deeply concerned about this because she's responsible for where the experiment went wrong. She holds herself responsible because she created the Archons. This is very clear. The Archons are her offspring. They're not intentional offspring. The idea that a goddess, a superhuman being of that level, could make a mistake and do something unintentionally is itself a profound awakening.
Yeah, it really is.
You know? And it creates sympathy and empathy for her. If you understand that part of her story, you can realize, to put it in very mundane language, how deeply concerned she is
mm-hmm.
about this predatory problem that we have in our own midst, you know?
Yes, indeed. Well, John, we're just starting to get into this very big question, you know, about how to correct this and how to deal with the archontic challenge that's been here, you know, pretty much for our whole existence on Earth.
Right.
But, so we're just getting into it, so I don't want to put a stop to things as we are now, but we do need to round things up just time-wise with the the memory and all that. So let's go on with this in the next talk, which we can schedule for a later time.
All right.
We'll leave people to ponder on what we've talked about today.
Agreed.
Fantastic. Now, is there anything you would like to add in closing before we sign off here?
Yeah, I just want to say mm-hmm. that since this is the first talk we've had since the Japan event, I'd like to announce, if I haven't done it already, I don't think I did this in a previous talk,
mm-hmm.
that everyone will remember in their mind March 11th, 3/11, the day of the Japanese earthquake. Those of us who are engaged in planetary tantra will remember a day 8 days after that.
Yes.
Which was March 19th.
Yeah.
Yeah. And March 19th was the day that something happened in the dynamic of the Earth, Sun, Moon system, something very unusual. I'd actually been waiting since 1976 for this to happen. So I've been waiting 35 years of my life for this to happen. And not sharing it with anyone. I never spoke to anyone about it for those 35 years.
Wow.
And that event is that the movement of the barycenter through the material core of the Earth would exceed the speed of sound. So we'll talk, and that happened on March 19th of this year, 8 days after the earthquake. And that event, which is a real geophysical event, can talk about it at length, and we will do more so in the future. Explain exactly what that event is. We'll go over the details of it. That event is what allowed Sophia in her planetary form to establish a signal contact with the galactic core. And so if you would imagine her as a great mother ship, a great ocean liner that was lost in stormy seas, and her communication system went down for quite a long time. She lost contact with the home port. But then, at a certain moment, she restores her navigational and communication system. She sends a signal out to the home port, and that begins a process where she is directed back on course. So this is the beginning of Gaia's correction in the geophysical sense, 8 days after the Japanese earthquake of 2011. And from this point on, all bets are off, and the game is entirely different. I don't predict, Thomas, but I'd like to close this interview by saying this. I can guarantee you that we on this planet are going to see anomalies in the sky, in the earth, anomalies of nature, anomalies of the electronic field of the earth, and anomalies and mutations in our own body that are going to exceed the wildest imagination.
Absolutely.
As Gaia makes, as she makes her correction, she is nature. She is nature. And we think we understand the laws of nature and that the laws of nature are fixed. The laws of nature are not fixed. You know what the laws of nature are? They're whatever she wants them to be. Okay? And we're going to see the laws of nature turned inside out and upside down. And it's already starting to happen, the anomalies that are being reported all around the world. And we're going to also see a lot more of this so-called UFO activity. But a lot of it is not really UFO activity. It's not the invasion of the Archons. It's just disturbances in the plasmatic electron due to her course correction. So don't get freaked out by that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Fantastic, fantastic. Yeah, and really people be looking forward to this. Really is the momentous moment, and there's a lot of things to talk about, what expired around that time and the events
That's
after
right.
that and the significance of it. So please be keeping those things in mind and kind of research around on the events that happened on that day or around that time. All right, John, so I will let you go for today, and we will set up a schedule for the next time.
Certainly.
Okay.
As soon as next week sometime, perhaps we can pick it up again.
Great. That sounds wonderful.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Talk to you later. Love the box.